like to thank the organizers for having me, and I hope you find this talk as interesting as I found the talks leading up to it. It's been a pretty interesting series of presentations. I'm going to talk about some unpublished work that I did while I was up until a couple months ago in David Kleinfeld's lab. I was lucky to have a wonderful group of collaborators involved in this. I'm going to talk about the cortical vasculature, so particularly the blood vessels that supply your brain with a constant stream of oxygen and nutrients. So on the cortex, the outside part of the brain where the so-called higher functions take place, if you look on the surface, there's a network of arteries and veins. So the arteries come up, they branch, there is some interconnection, and the branches then go down into the cortex, into the neurons, they split into the capillary bed, which then comes back together, goes through an ascending vein here, and then goes back down carrying the blood. So this is sort of the general architecture of the transport system to the brain. So it turns out that whenever neurons are active, their metabolic rate goes up, and through a wide variety of signaling mechanisms that are still not completely understood, they cause a local increase in blood flow. So this is the basis of fMRI and other sensing methods, and this is what Seiji Ogawa used to look at look at contrast. So what happens is, this is your brain in an fMRI scanner. You look at a complicated, a checkerboard pattern, a very strong visual stimulus, and what happens is in the visual cortex there's an increase in blood flow. There's an oversupply of blood. It oversupplies oxygen and nutrients, so the local oxygenation goes up. There's also an increase in blood volume, and so to do this you need to decrease the local resistance of the vascular network in order to get a local increase in blood flow. So how do you do this? So basically the vessels in your brain are pipes, and we know quite a bit about flow through pipes. It's very simple. Your flow is going to be related to pressure, viscosity, length, and diameter. So things like viscosity and length are not something that you can modulate on the second time scale, the kind of time scale that you see these changes in blood flow. So they're not something that they're not really a free parameter. You can modulate pressure. You can change the heart rate slower or faster, but this isn't a local effect. This is going to affect flow throughout the entire body. So the only thing you really have that you can modulate flow is by changing the diameter. So arteries in particular have muscles around them so that the neurons can relax and constrict them through neural activity, just the way you can relax and constrict the muscles in other parts of your body. So if you relax the muscles, you get an increase, you drop the resistance, and you get an increase in flow. And you can see also that sort of falling out of this is that flow and volume are related. You can't modulate flow without changing the local blood volume. You can't modulate flow locally without changing the local blood volume, rather. So it's an open question where in the vasculature this blood volume takes place. In addition to the arteries, there are also the veins, which can also distend in other parts of the body. So there was a very influential experiment by Mandeville about 12 years ago, where he looked at flow, and he measured this using laser Doppler in an anesthetized rat in which he was electrically stimulating one of the paws. And he also measured volume using small metal ion iron particles in the brain using MRI methods. So what he found was that when he stimulated for a short period of time, the flow would go up and very quickly, and then it would relax back very quickly. And a similar thing happened with the volume. The volume went up, and then it went down very quickly, and the flow tracked the volume for a short stimulus. However, when he went for a longer stimulus, for about 30 seconds, the flow went up, and it kind of plateaued, whereas the volume kept going up. And then when he stopped stimulating, the flow immediately dropped down, and the volume dropped down much slower. So this was used as evidence for what's called the balloon model. this, they believe that this is caused by a slow venous distension. So the blood flow keeps coming in, and the veins very gradually increase because there are some nonlinearities in the mechanics of veins, and there's a delayed compliance. So the argument was that a lot of the change in blood volume you saw was actually a passive thing, a sort of biomechanical consequence of the change in flow, and it was in the veins. And so the thing to remember is that the flow, the time constants of relaxation for flow and volume are going to differ depending on the different stimuli, if this is really the case. However, there are using other techniques and other stimulation paradigms. Some other people have argued that the change in volume takes place in the arteries. So using NMR measurements of a fluorocarbon tracer that's reactive, that senses oxygen level, there's estimates that actually, as you increase the flow, plotted here, the change in volume happens mostly in the arterial component rather than the venous component. So there are a lot of papers arguing both ways, and many of them have, and they have subtle methodological differences. So bear that in mind. So this sort of points to two contradicting arguments for volume change. One is the classical balloon model, in which maybe the arteries dilate a little bit, and then you get some distension in the veins. And it's not fair to have one model with a cute name. You have to give the other model a cute name as well. So I'm going to call this the bagpipe model. So you have the artery dilation accounts for the large amount of the volume change. So this is important because these volume changes are a lot of what's sensed in fMRI experiments. So a lot of what you look at these activations are really, you know, indicators of one of these cases. And it also tells you something about the control mechanism of the vasculature, how active and how passive it is. So in this case, it's almost completely under neural control. It's all the volume change is taking place in the arteries. The arteries have muscles around them. You control the muscles. You know, it's somewhere in the brain. It's completely controlled. Whereas here, it's more of a biomechanical effect. It's just sort of, you know, the flow is kind of sloppy and goes everywhere, and you just have the veins stretch out and catch it. So there are two very different mechanisms. So I wanted to go in and answer which one of these is the case. And it's actually kind of technically difficult to do. So what you really want to do is you want to go in and directly measure the diameters of these vessels. You don't want to use a technique that makes assumptions about what you're measuring. And you need to do that with very high resolution because, as I'll show you in the mouse, the small arteries and arterioles that we're looking at have diameters of 10 to 20 microns. We also want to do this in a way that we perturb the brain as little as possible. So as you've seen many times in the past couple days, when you touch the brain, it's bad. We want to avoid inflammation, and we want to maintain normal intracranial pressure. This is especially important when you're studying the vasculature because in addition to all sorts of other things going on, if you cause wounds and damage, you cause a leukocyte or white blood cell recruitment. And they stick to the walls, and they can actually basically plug everything up and drastically change what's going on in the flow and decrease flow a lot. And lastly, you want to not use anesthesia. You don't want to do this in an anesthetized animal, and you want to use a more natural sensory stimulation. You don't want to do it in with electric shocks or something. And this is because when you're anesthetized, you're basically half dead. When you look at the metabolic rate in the awake cortex, it's very high. You know, and as you gradually increase the anesthetic level, basically it falls by half. And it's very hard to tell by just looking at measures of metabolic rate in someone who's surgically anesthetized from somebody who's in a coma. So this is not the sort of state where you want to be studying, you know, the neural recruitment of blood flow. So the first way to get high resolution images, we're going to use two photon microscopy. And this was invented by Watt Webb and Winfried Denck about 17, 18 years ago. I think the patent's coming off very soon. So So in normal fluorescence microscopy, you come in, you shine, say, a blue light on your fluorophore, and it emits green light. And this has the advantage that you separate the incoming and outcoming light. And that's shown here. So this is a cuvette of fluorescein, which is yellow number 7. You probably eat it in candy or something. It's relatively non-toxic. And when you shine blue light in it, coming out of this objective here, you see that there's two cones of fluorescence. So here at the focal volume, you're getting fluorescence before the focal volume, after. So if you wanted to look at something in here, you're just going to get light from all over. There's no way of separating in-plane and out-of-plane focal stuff. It's going to look like a big blurry image. So there's a trick to get around this, and that's using a nonlinear optic. So if you have, instead of putting in blue light, you have a very bright but very briefly pulsed infrared light, you can knock the electron and the molecule up to a higher excited state, and you get fluorescence out. So these two differ in that this two-photon effect, as it's called, is highly nonlinear. It only happens at the focal point of where you're imaging. So, and that's shown here. So right here, there's a pulsed infrared laser coming in, and you see that there's only fluorescence coming from one tiny spot. So this is about you can get it down to about a micron in volume. So you can scan this spot with your laser around, and you know, you get fluorescence or not fluorescence depending on whether you're on something that's fluorescing or not. So you can fill the vasculature with a dye and see where it is and not. And you scan it in a raster pattern just like you would a television. And this way you can generate movies, you can generate, you know, images, and that allows us to look into the brain. The other particular advantage is infrared light, long wavelength light, doesn't scatter as much going into the brain. So the brain is a highly opaque medium. It's not something that you'd want to, you know, look through to see something. So by using longer wavelength light, it goes through better. So the second trick is to avoid inflammation is we actually don't take off the skull. I developed a method to image through the skull in the mouse without damaging. So the trick is mouse skull, if you thin it enough and then you polish it, becomes optically transparent. It's basically almost like a little thin piece of glass. So if you thin it to about 50 microns and you put some super glue and a glass cover slip on it, you mechanically reinforce it. And this prevents bone regrowth, which is important. So it stays stable for months. But it's also optically transparent. So, you know, a couple months later, you can go in and you can see the vasculature perfectly fine. It doesn't seem to cause any sort of damage to the vasculature. So we can go in and look at the capillary network 2 days after the surgery, 2 weeks, and a month. And then basically the network maintains a similar shape. So if you cut yourself, this causes vessel remodeling. We don't think that the vessels are remodeling in this case. So we think that there's very little inflammation. And then since today is the day of the astrocytes, so we call this the polished reinforced thin skull method, or Porck's window, to be cute. So if you look at GFAP staining under the polished thin skull window here, and you compare it to the control, basically you see similar levels of astrocytic GFAP staining. So there's basically a low basal level in the mouse brain at all times. Whereas if you go in and you take off the skull and you put a glass window in, you see a large level of astrocytic activation here relative to the contralateral control. And this is consistent with what everybody who does chronic imaging sees. So this has been a constant bugaboo in the field, but we think we've gotten around it using this method. As far as we can tell, there's no astrocytic activation. We're also looking at microglia, which are the small immune cells in the brain, which react to damage and insults by changing their morphology. So normally they have this highly ramified shape here, and then if there's an insult, like a blood-brain barrier disruption, they develop a very amoeboid shape. And you can see that both under the window and under the contralateral hemisphere, there's basically no difference in the morphology. And then we can go and we can look at these in vivo. And so they have these fine processes, which are submicron size. They're very, very tiny, that reach all over the place. They're constantly surveying both the neurons, the synapses, and the blood vessels. And we can go in vivo and we take something which we call a Z-stack. So we take an image, we move the focal plane down, take another image. So you have a movie where each frame is slightly deeper in the brain. And I'll show you that here. So you can see the nicely labeled microglia and their highly ramified processes. And you can see the capillary network down below it going through. So, and so we can see a couple hundred microns down into the brain in this manner. So lastly, we want to do this in an awake animal. So we habituated mice to be very comfortable and sit very still underneath the microscope. And instead of doing electric shocks or some sort of really nasty stimulus, we're using air puffs. So it's a nice, gentle somatosensory stimulus. And we apply them either to the vibrissa, that is the whiskers on their face, which are very sensitive and are represented by a large area in their cortex. And we can image blood flow in the vibrissa-related area. And as a control to make sure we're not having some sort of non-specific activation or changes in blood flow, we have a air puffer aimed at the tail, so we can kind of compare the two. So the mice, over a week become very comfortable sitting in this little tube, and we can image the blood vessels with a high resolution. So, okay, so what do we see? So over here, I have an image showing the pial vasculature, so that these are the large blood vessels on the surface that I showed you in the first slide that sort of branch out and supply they're the large arteries and veins. And because you're probably not used to looking at these, I've schematicized them here. So the arteries are in red and the veins are in blue. You can usually tell them apart because the arteries are on top of the veins. So we can look at the diameter of these vessels while the animal sits very calmly. I've boxed off four of these little areas. And if we look at the diameter over time, while the animal's just sitting there, this is sort of resting state measurement, we see that the arteries have lots of oscillations in their diameter, and this is mostly present below 1 hertz, whereas the veins have maybe a very slow oscillation and have much less power. So this in people, when you tell someone to sit in an MRI machine, you say, close your eyes and just relax, you see these sorts of slow oscillations here. So we think the mice are in a similar sort of mental state as, I don't know, a bored undergraduate or something who you're paying. So I guess that's good. The next thing we want to know is, well, what happens in the capillary bed? How does the blood flow in the capillary bed change? So we can go into single capillaries and measure velocity through the capillaries. So remember, we label the blood with a fluorescent tracer. So when we can do line scans across the capillary. So we scan the laser beam across the capillary repeatedly over time. And as the red blood cell moves, it's going to be a dark spot since it's not fluorescing. So its position is going to change with time. It's going to generate basically a dark streak. And so the angle of this dark streak tells us the velocity. So if this were a horizontal line, it wouldn't be moving. If it were a much steeper line, it would be moving much faster. So you get something like this out of the data. You get as the red blood cells show up as dark streaks, the fluorescently labeled plasma show up as light streaks, and we want to extract this angle from it. So you really end up with basically, minutes of data, and it's manually impossible to do this, and it's borderline crazy to try. So we use an automated method. We use the radon transform, which basically takes at every different angle, it takes an integral along lines at various radii from the center of the image. So you convert your XY image into theta radius space. And what happens is you see that there's a region, an angle at which there's a light and dark streaks. There's a larger variance. So if you look at the variance as a function of angle in radon space, you see this nice clear peak which corresponds to this angle, which you can then calculate the velocity from. So it actually does this extremely well. It does it about as well as a human does. So for computer vision, that's pretty great. So we go into the capillaries, the small vessels in the brain, which the red blood cells are moving in a single file manner, and we can measure the velocity over time. And we see that while the animal is sitting still, similar to the artery diameter, you see that there are slow oscillations in velocity. So they have a very similar time course, and they're controlled by the arterial dilation. So I've magnified this region here, and here's the raw data. You can see as the streaks get progressively steeper, the velocity goes up. And these high-frequency oscillations are due to the heart rate. So the heart rate sort of propagates, you know. And so when you take the Fourier transform, you see a clean peak around where the heart rate is, and you see lots of power at the low frequency below 1 hertz. And if you remember, that's where the arteries are spontaneously dilating and constricting. So the slow dilations in the arteries are reflected in the flow through the capillaries. All right, so the next question is, well, what happens when you actually give a stimulus? So here again is a picture of blood vessels. I have a schematic here. So these are veins in blue, and an artery, and a penetrating artery here, one of the arteries that dives into the brain. And what's going to happen is I'm going to show you the dilation in response to a 30-second long series of air puffs to the whiskers. And so what's going to happen is there's going to be a dilation in the arteries, a very quick one, and then a sort of a slower one following that, and there'll be a slow dilation in the veins. And there's some movement because the animal jumps around, but we can compensate for that. So the stimulation is going to come on up there, and then you can see the dilation in the arteries. The animal twitches a little, and then you see the arteries constrict a little bit, and they will gradually get bigger again. So the stimulation is on, and then when the stimulus shuts off in a few seconds, you'll see that the arteries rapidly return to baseline within a few seconds. This is roughly real time, so this gives you an idea of the dynamics of how these things happen when you're sitting in a dark room watching this on the computer screen. So the stimulus goes off, and then the arteries constrict. Okay, so when you look, if you go in and you look at the diameters at various different points in the network, in the vascular network over time, so this is a baseline image taken right before stimulus starts, and this is towards the end of the stimulation taken here. This is a 30-second long stimulus. So, for example, you look at this green vein here, you see that there's a very slow dilation in response to stimulus that slowly relaxes back after the stimulus stops, and then a similar thing for this vein. The arteries have a very different dynamic. You see that there's an initial strong dilation, which kind of relaxes a bit and then slowly builds up again. And then once the stimulus turns off, they constrict pretty rapidly. And if you fit the decays of the veins and the arteries, they have very different time constants. So veins are about 50 seconds, maybe more, and arteries are on the order of 5 seconds. So it actually depends a great deal on how long the stimulus is. So if you look across the population, you get a very similar response. Oh, one last thing. This gray line is the control. So this is the puff towards the tail, sort of a non-specific response. So you see that the veins don't respond to the non-specific other stimulus, and you get an initial dilation in arteries, but it's nowhere near as strong, and it goes away. So there's a sort of general activation to any stimulus at first, but it becomes more and more specific as time goes on. So if you look across the population on the arteries, you see that there's a strong initial dilation, then a gradual increase, and then a rapid relaxation when you have a 30-second long stimulus. The veins very slowly track with a longer time constant and then relax back with a much slower time constant. So I'm plotting the diameter versus time here. And as far as we can tell with the capillaries, there isn't much of any change in the volume. Whereas if you looked in response to a very brief stimulus, the veins don't respond at all. The capillaries don't either. This is a movement artifact, but you still get a strong and specific response in the arteries. So there's you can still get dilation. This is a single air puff. It's a very brief, tiny stimulus. So what happens in the capillaries? So as you can remember, when we looked at the velocity in the capillaries during spontaneous activity, it tracked the dilation of the surface arterioles, and we see a similar effect in response to sensory stimulation. So if you have the sensory stimulation, you see initial large increase in blood flow, it relaxes back and then climbs back and then relaxes again once the stimulus is off. And it's also very specific. You have only a small sort of startle response to a non-specific stimuli. And it's important that these effects are very different under anesthesia. So if you take the same animal and you put it under anesthesia and you compare the responses, so this bright red here is in the awake animal, and this dark red here is the anesthetized animal. So this is the arterial diameter during stimulation. You see that there's an enormous difference. So it's like there's about a three or four fold difference in dilation relative in the arteries, in the awake versus the anesthetized case. So you're going to get very different responses in blood flow and volume. Additionally, you don't see any dilation in the veins in the anesthetized case. So it's very, if you want to apply, you know, your animal models to human fMRI studies, you really can't do this under anesthesia. It gives you the wrong answer. Arteries and so if we want to try to figure out, you know, I've shown you diameters, can we calculate volume changes from this? So here I'm showing you volume changes in response to a 10-second long stimulus and a 30-second long stimulus. And I'm assuming that the arteries are roughly one-fifth the volume contribution of the veins. And this is, these numbers don't matter very much, but there's a lot of estimates around that range. It doesn't matter what exact numbers you pick, but you get very similar responses. And that is basically when you have a short stimulus, because the veins aren't recruited, the relaxation in the volume following stimulation is very fast. It's mostly the arteries contribute. So it's about 4 seconds, where when you have a longer stimulus, you have both the arterial and the venous component, and when you fit it, you get about a 17-second time constant, which is really similar, actually, to Mandeville's paper. So you see that his time constants actually match up reasonably well with what we get. So we can look at blood flow at the single vessel level in an awake animal without perturbing the vascular network as little as possible. And from this, we were able to learn that the sort of two models that I set up in the beginning, the balloon and the bagpipe, are both, you know, to certain degrees right. So you have initially a large arterial dilation, which, if you have a prolonged stimulus, causes a slow venous distension and a more passive dilation of the veins. So it's a bagpipe than a balloon. It's not either or. And these dynamics depend a great deal on the animal's anesthetic state and the duration of the stimulus. All right. Thank you. So the blood, depending on, again, it's hard to get good estimates. The blood volume is about 2 or 3% of the brain volume. It's probably more closer to the surface because there are these large peel vessels. I don't know if there's any good in vivo measurements of changes in brain volume of the entire brain, changes in brain volume following stimulus. Stimulation. I mean, you get glial cell swelling, I think, in slices when you basically have no blood and there's no constraint. I don't know how big they are relative to each other, but that's a definite possibility that, you know, you have I think the measurements of blood volume that people make are using the inject basically iron particles into the bloodstream, and they don't cross the blood-brain barrier. So I think those measurements are relatively uncontaminated by any change in brain volume. But any change in brain volume is going to push on the vessels too, and it's going to fight. They're going to fight each other. One thing we do see is at the really long, a minute after stimulation, you actually see a constriction of the blood vessels. Nobody knows if this is some sort of passive mechanical effect, something smooshing it, for example, like glial cells swelling, or if it's an active effect. So that it may actually play in at the longer time scales. That this is a definite possibility.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the capillaries don't change in diameter.
They don't change in diameter, but the speed goes up. Yeah, the speed tracks the, so this is the velocity through capillaries, and it looks similar to the arterial diameter.
So the pressure increases?
Yeah. The local delta P, yeah. So. The velocity. Yes.
Well, is it much different from similar spectrum for arteries in other parts of the body?
So this is this is a good point. There's something called vasomotion that people discovered well over 100 years ago, looking at blood flow in the bat wing or something like that. And there are slow oscillations in flow in all vessels in the body, less than a hertz. Nobody knows where it comes from or what it does or if it's what it is. And we know that if you dissect out an artery and you intubate it and you pressurize it and you blow fluid through it, a lot of times they'll show these spontaneous, tenth of a hertz oscillations. So the way I think of it, which may not be right, but sort of my working model, is that these vessels, when there's no sort of neural signal to them, they just sort of oscillate. They have this sort of natural oscillation. But when a stimulus comes in, the neurons are active. The vessels basically track what the neurons are telling them what to do. And I don't see these slow oscillations when I'm stimulating. They go away. Yeah, it could, it could be just an emergent phenomenon from the fluid mechanics. But yeah, it's tough to study to sort of dissect everything out. But that's an interesting point, yeah.
Does the anesthesia by itself do anything to
the? Some do. Okay, so the anesthesia that I used was urethane, which I don't think does anything to the vessels. So isoflurane actually will dilate smooth muscle by itself. If you dissect out a vessel and you put isoflurane on it, it will actually dilate it. And you actually... if you look at blood flow in someone anesthetized with isoflurane, it actually goes up dramatically. Basically, all the blood vessels go like this. And
but that's not the explanation. Did you normalize the baseline diameter?
Yeah.
Maxed out the diameter?
Yeah. No. No. Yeah. Yeah. Changes in diameter. Yeah. Yeah. So I have ideas, but so there's sort of two components here. So you have this initial dilation and then a slow ramp up. I think this initial dilation is some sort of feed forward, either noradrenergic or acetylcholine kind of response. We know that there are sort of these sort of inner nerves coming onto the blood vessels, and they're a little bit less specific in the response, but it's very fast. And I And people always talk about the glia modulating blood flow. A lot of the molecules that glia release, you know, and are very vasoactive, and they have these end feet that are wrap around the blood vessel. And they've got to be doing something. But if you actually look at the papers where they people talk about where they put a calcium-sensitive dye into glia and they stimulate the network, they don't see responses for 5 or 10 seconds afterwards. Calcium-sensitive responses in glia, which doesn't mean they don't release stuff, but I think that's what's happening here. I think there are two components. This is a glial component, and then this is some other sort of general activation kind of component. It's tough to dissect out pharmacologically, you know, getting something in the brain at a constant concentration and all sorts of things. But I think the one of the powers of the mouse model is that you can get specific knockouts targeted to cell types, and you can remove some of these activating substances from, say, the glia or the neurons or something, and then go in and measure changes in blood flow and see if that contributes. So hopefully, you know, by using knockouts, we can get at this. So I'm measuring in a window, it's like a couple millimeters across, and it's encompassing basically the vibrissal-related cortex, and there's another region called the unresponsive zone, because in an anesthetized animal, it doesn't respond to anything. In an awake animal, it responds to everything. So I'm probably no more than a millimeter away from, but there's definitely going to be activation in the unresponsive zone, as it's the so-called unresponsive zone. We need to go in and measure neural activity. So neural activity isn't as well confined as people like to say it is. So if you, there's a very nice series of experiments from Ron Frastick's lab where they go in and they wiggle a single vibrissa, and they put electrodes, you know, several millimeters away in auditory cortex, and they can see responses slave to the whisker response. So this they're much smaller than in the vibrissa related area, but they go out for millimeters. So the neural activity isn't restricted into one area. It spreads out, but it falls off. So it would be a really nice experiment to look at how it matches with the blood flow, how they fall off together.